My name is George Au Jr. I was born in Santa Cruz, and I lived in the last Santa Cruz Chinatown. There were four or five, depending how you count. But since we couldn't own land before 1943 easily, we didn't have control over our fate. And so it wasn't until after the Chinese exclusion law of 1882 was taken off the books that year, the year I was born, that we could become citizens, own land, and start to gain the rights that white people had. And that last Santa Cruz Chinatown was pretty much obliterated by the flood of 1955. So it's completely gone. It's right across the street from the mall. And it's rebuilt into restaurants and offices and a shop or two. And I'm one of the last people that remember that Chinatown because I lived there and I happened to be born at the right time. And the wonderful thing about it is that I got to meet the old bachelors, the Chinese men who came over as youngsters, 18, 20 years old, some younger, some older. And they were sent from China because their families were starving. And so they had to go wherever they could and find jobs. And usually they were the hardest, lowest paying jobs. They had to survive first and then send whatever they could back home so that their mother and their father and their brothers and sisters wouldn't starve to death. Because at the time that they came over, and for a long time before and after, millions and millions of people starved to death every year. And so I got to see these old guys at the end of their lives when they were old. That was just the timing of it. I was 3, 4, and 5 years old, and they were in their 70s or 80s, and they had worked their whole lives in Gold Mountain in the United States. Now they were fading out. They had reached the end of their days, and whatever dreams that they had about striking it rich in California, and some, a small percentage did, and then they would go back and have money to spend and buy land, fix up their homes, things like that. But the great percentage did not. And then they died here, and basically they died alone. And that was especially true for the guys that I knew, that I had met, that I saw sitting on the benches in Chinatown. They were the last survivors, I would say. During World War II, the people had the opportunity to get defense jobs and other kinds of jobs because the men were gone. And so the Chinese, like the Rosie the Riveter women and other minorities, they got the opportunity that they never would have had without the war and a shortage of workers. And things changed with that. And the position of Chinese changed with what the wider, greater population thought of the Chinese. Now the Chinese were allies. They were on our side. They were seen as people who fought alongside of us. And of course, the unfortunate poor Japanese folks that lived here, they got sent to the camps. I was born in 43, and so a lot of my classmates and my friends who happened to be Japanese were born in the camps, and their poor mothers and fathers had to deal with that as adults. I think that's an interesting aspect of life, where the politics of it and the power structure turned out good for the Chinese and terrible for the Japanese, through no good deed or bad deeds that either one did. During the war, we were the allies. If we wanted meaning the United States, wanted to be the good guys, then why do we have these laws against the Chinese? And so they were gotten rid of. But in the time from 1882 to 1943, was that 61 years? White people were afraid of the Chinese. And so they said, well, if we allow the Chinese to come in like we do people from England or France or Italy or Russia, then we'll be overrun with Chinese. And it was hard enough to get in where the population almost died out. My grandparents and my parents were some of the rare Chinese that were able to get women over from China and have children and grandchildren. I was always told I was born under a lucky star, and I feel that way. And if it were just one thing that happened, the repeal of Chinese exclusion the year I was born, hey, that's a true statement. My grandfather was a cook, and that was a common occupation for Chinese people. And for some reason, maybe it was true, maybe it was just hearsay, white people who owned companies, ranches, businesses, thought that Chinese were good cooks. And of course, other qualities, like maybe showing up every day. And I guess that had to be true in some ways, because if the workers, the ranch hands, the whatever, weren't happy with their food, they wouldn't work. And they would probably lynch the cook. And so you'd better be good. And you had to please the ranch hands and the owners. And so if you look all around the historical photos, it's common to find the Chinese cook. You see all the white ranch hands or the lumberjacks or the whatever, and then you see the Chinese cook. That's so common. And so that's what my grandfather was. And that was thought to be a good job by Chinese people, because you didn't have to work outside digging ditches in the hot weather or in the snow, whatever it was. And there were a lot worse jobs and dangerous jobs and less paying jobs. Plus, most of the jobs the Chinese had as laborers and even skilled laborers, once the job was done, they wouldn't even give you a ride back to San Francisco. You had to walk back or pay your way. And that's what happened, like with the railroad. Did tremendous, tremendous, tremendous thing. But for the most part, except for now, today, they never got the credit. Then my other grandfather, my father's father, so he started off as a laundryman, which was a very common occupation for Chinese. Laundries, and then later on, grocery stores and restaurants. That was later on. But most of the time, people took jobs. They didn't have money or capital. My grandfather hated being a laundryman. The piles of laundry, and you washed and you ironed. When you ironed, the piles never stopped. And And it was hard work, because I think the iron weighed like 6 or 8 pounds. And so you had to keep putting it on top of the stove and then ironing. So he did not like that. And he didn't see a future in it. Like, we get problems typing on a computer. Can you imagine the physical labor and the wear and tear on your fingers and your skin and everything? Well, he got a terrible blister on his fingers. And he couldn't work anymore. So then he became a cook, a kind of like a handyman in a resort. It was called the Riverside Resort in Santa Cruz. And so he came down here from San Francisco, and he helped with baking and things like that. But he was one of these guys that was very entrepreneurial. So he's always trying to think of ways to get ahead, because in the culture there, they always said, you will never get ahead working for someone else. So he tried a teeny store. And then what he did was he got people to put in money. That's what you had to do. And it's a very accepted way for Chinese and other immigrants to get a start. People put in and pooled their money. And he tried to start a restaurant. He tried a few other things too. He's always looking. Then he found apples. Santa Cruz and Watsonville were beginning to be an apple area. Other areas had blight on their apples. The apples grown in Watsonville, Aptos, and Santa Cruz, they hadn't been hit by whatever the fungus or insect was yet. So he found out that there was this thing and a process called drying apples that extended the life of the product. And if you were smart and you were in the game early, what you would do is you would say to the apple orchard owner, I'll take your bruised apples. You can get rid of them. I'll clear them all out. And in the beginning, you could get those for free. So you would go to the Chinese workers who you could speak to really easily and say, I have a deal for you. You could work inside. You cut apples and you lay them on pieces of wood. And then we dry them. The advantage is if you needed workers to do work the Chinese could do, then you had the advantage, because you knew how they think, what their needs were, and how to communicate with them. And so he started an apple drying business. Now, to do that, you need land and a building. You could get the apple from the guys that grew them, but to cut and dry them, you needed a building and ovens and things like that. But if you're Chinese, you couldn't own the land. You couldn't control your fate that way. My granddad found a white partner. And so the white partner would provide the building, the apple drying building, and he would provide other things that went along with that, and my grandfather would provide the labor. They needed each other. And they made enough of a profit where I think they started in 1905, somewhere around there, between 1905 and 1910. And for a dozen years, they made enough money to continue doing business together. Then World War I came. people that produced food or had food or had the right to the food with the futures, they made lots of money. My grandfather, a Chinese guy, who beforehand was trying to scrape things together and get by, he was able to buy a new car every year. I mean, is that crazy? Yeah, that is crazy. What happened then, 1930, my aunt graduated from Santa Cruz High. And so my grandfather decided to take the family back to China. My grandfather was willing to put up with anything when he came over circa 1900 as a young man. He's willing to take all the discrimination, the dangerous jobs, the low-paying jobs, whatever, because he had to do what he had to do. But now that he was successful, what happened was that he was dissatisfied. He did not like it that he couldn't go to any restaurant, any barbershop, could not own land, could not vote, could not become a citizen. All that stuff, it irked him. He wanted to enjoy his success as if he were white, but that wasn't going to happen. And it looked like every year in 22 and 12 and 02, they kept renewing the 10-year period for Chinese exclusion. So he thought they would do it forever. It did not look like it would ever change. And he thought, my money will go further in China. I can be a big man in China. I can own land in China. And my daughter, who just graduated from high school, I'll put her through college, and she'll have all the opportunities in China. And so will my son. But Lam Pon was not dumb. He knew that China was so screwed up. It was at the end of a dynasty, and the dynasty should have been overthrown 100 years ago, but the West didn't want it to be overthrown. They wanted to be a docile, weak country that they could control and sell opium and things like that in at will, and control different parts of the economy, that sort of thing. And so he said, things are terrible, terrible in China, but I don't see the future changing for my kids or me in America. So he took off. So when I compare my two grandfathers, and they knew each other, and it was such a small place, the only handful of Chinese and basically lived together. And so this one, he had the money and he chose to go back to China. So he goes back to a time of warlords, Japan taking Manchuria and other things, the Japanese invasion before our World War II, and then World War II, and then the Civil War, and that was going on before too, between Chiang and Mao, and then the great starvations of the Great Leap Forward, all kinds of upsets like the Cultural Revolution, and all during this time, millions and millions of people starved to death because the communists could not run the country. They were inept, just as inept as the nationalists under Chiang were. And then he finally died in 1968 at age 90. Somehow he made it through lots of danger. And then my other grandfather, my mother's father, he stayed. He stayed because he did not have the money to go back. If he had the money to go back, he would have brought everybody back. Or at least he would have gone back, at least. That happened too. But he didn't have the money. And nowhere near that. They could barely feed themselves and pay the rent. But as he grew older, his kids, my mom and my aunts and uncles, they started getting jobs. They started with paper routes, the Sentinel, and then they did this and that. And then they took care of their mom and dad. And so I think that in 1930, when Lam Pong went back to China, this grandfather, if you looked into his head, he might have been envious. And he lived a boring, threadbare life here. And the other guy had money to build buildings and own land. But he went through terrible times, what the Chinese call interesting times, which is a curse. And hey, I own these buildings, but all these people starving to death around me, they could take it any time. And they did when the communists took over. And it was so precarious. So the great percentage of the people who came over were men. The United States did not want women to come over because then you have children and then you have too many Chinese. And so that was the purpose of that. And I think there were 17 men to every one woman, something like that. And so that made a terrible imbalance, and these guys would never basically have female companionship, love, sex, families, all those sorts of things. But their families were desperate back in China, and so this had to be done. And there were some who found ways to get around that. And that's why you have families. And if it were different, if there was no Chinese exclusion, if there was no bias, there was no prejudice, all that sort of thing, then they could have become just as successful as Andrew Carnegie or Joe Kennedy or Leland Stanford. But it wasn't that way. And so most of them died, as I said, amongst their peers. The last ones died basically alone, because it's like if you had a group of people and they were 100, 18 to 20 year olds when you first came over, and you had energy and big dreams and you could work hard all day. And then by the time you're 80, it's you and Joe left. And you can barely get to the store, all that sort of thing. Barely get out of bed. And then when you were younger, you took care of shipping the bones back to China. And now who's going to take care of your bones? So if you are the last one or two, their brains are kind of scrambled because they're old. They can't remember everything. They can't remember to take your body out of the coffin after 10 years and clean off the bones and put it in a box and ship it to your village. Now, they had systems like this, but if you're the last one on a desert island, who's going to bury you? And so that's who the people were that are still there. Because the Chinese who had died before, when the system was in place, after 10 years, the bones were cleaned, put in a box, and sent back to their home village. And that system really, really worked. And so those are the people who are in the cemetery. If you were born at the right time, your bones got sent back. If you weren't, and you are still buried there, then you are stuck. You're in between. According to the way it's supposed to be, you won't have your family praising you and thinking about you and providing food for you and recognition for what you had done. And so that is who is there and who was there. One of the guys that I knew, and if you look at a book called Chinatown Dreams, you see me with this guy, Chin Lai. He's in his 80s and I'm about 4. He died in about 1948 or so. He was buried and they put a redwood marker up. That's what they did. A redwood marker was cheap then. Now redwood's so precious. But then it was cheap. And they would write in black ink, "This is Chin Lai." He was born in East Lake Village, outside of Toisan, in the year of the emperor, da-da. So let's say he was born in 1860, and he died in 1948 in Santa Cruz. And it has these things. These redwood grave markers would be, they would let them fall into the bushes, because the Chinese section was on the outside, on the other side of the fence. And so it was kind of like a rough area. And there wasn't that much business going on there. And they didn't have people, ceremonies that families would go to, because there were no families, basically. And so somebody found the grave marker. He died in 1948. So in 1985, his grave marker was found. Why hadn't it fallen into the bushes and through all kinds of weather rotted? It turns out for generations, there was a tree house above the cemetery. Between the cemetery and the housing that's up on the Upper West Side. And the kids would be building and rebuilding the tree house. The story is, it was like a 1x6, okay? It was used as part of the floor for this tree house, which people that I have talked to played in when they were a kid. And it happened to be that whoever used that wood, who placed it, put the writing on the bottom side where no one would walk on it. The other side was worn pretty much. And if the sides were reversed, then you wouldn't be able to see. The writing would have been rubbed off. But the writing was as almost as if it were done recently in black ink on redwood. And at that time, we published Chinese Gold by Sandy Leiden. Sandy not only did the research, I think that the spirits of all the Chinese pioneers got into his psyche. And so he's speaking for them. And so I think that Chin Lai knew all this. And we were going to have an exhibit for Chinese Gold and the Chinese community in Santa Cruz at the mall. Okay? And when we were getting everything together for the exhibit, someone came in and said, "You got to have this." And when my aunt translated, "Whose marker is this?" It was Chin Lai's. And Chin Lai is all over Chinatown Dreams. And he's in there with me. I mean, I'm so proud to be in there with him. And what we all figured out was that Chin Lai's spirit, who was alone all these years, and we don't know whether he's there or whether he's back at the village, he wanted to be part of the publication of the book, and he wanted to be part of the celebration of him and his peers and so many others, and he wanted to be at the mall. So now that grave marker is at the mall, and it's brought out for special exhibits. And it's an amazing, wonderful thing. Got to see it. Also, a group of us here who really speak for the Chinese and many others, we feel the story of the hungry ghosts. So the hungry ghosts are ghosts that have been put upon, taken advantage of, maybe murdered, like a Macbeth or a Hamlet, and so they come back. And if they're not taken care of, they can cause terrible things. They can bring you bad luck. And so Sandy Lydon, Jeffrey Dunn, Sibley Simon, and Nina Simon, who were all parts of getting the gate done, the gate at Evergreen, they feel, we feel, that these people had to be recognized anyway, and that we did not want angry spirits haunting Santa Cruz. Now, I see it, since I lived with the last of them, I really feel their energy. Now, I personally feel the ones that I knew and my family, ghosts, spirits, they really help me. And I feel really in tune with them. And the Chinese gate and the exhibit and the reproduction in bronze of the redwood grave markers and the whole story behind it, what we're doing now, it brings honor and recognition to all those Chinese pioneers. And the way that I see it, before recent years, there were tens or hundreds of thousands of these ghosts walking the streets and the forests of Santa Cruz. I mean, I could feel them. And so they got happier when the books were done. They got happier when the Chinese gate was done and everything that went around it and all the hoopla that goes around it, which this is part of. And so what I feel now is that there's so much good energy. So in Chinese history, when they wanted to say some large number, the number they chose was 10,000. 10,000. Because if you had 10,000 of anything, that was more than people could swallow or think about, could process, okay? And so I would say, using old numbers, that the books, the movies, the museum exhibits, the hoopla, and these two Chinese gates, the one with the dragon, the latest one, And the one that we are talking about at Evergreen, they are like 10,000 pieces, sticks of incense being burned every day. But of course, 10,000 is not so significant these days. So I'll change it to make something more apropos. I would say that it is us burning 10 billion sticks of incense a day. And so some people will say, as I do, that we want to keep these spirits happy so they don't bring misfortune or catastrophe. I go a little bit different. I say I want to honor them so much that I'm their guy. I'm their spokesperson and champion. And so they help me so much in things about my life. And so that's where I come from.